It's Marla Zink on behalf of Jarso Abdi.
This will give you a better appreciation of where you are.
And I'm going to try and focus this morning on the insufficient evidence for unlawful possession of a firearm and maybe touch on the hearsay evidence. Counsel for Saeed is going to focus on the insufficient evidence for attempted robbery count. What we have here is two weapons and three people. And we know that the state is not relying on a constructive possession theory for unlawful possession of a firearm, although that's what the state relied on at trial in arguing before the trial court on the motion to dismiss. So what we need evidence of a firearm in Mr. Abdi's hands, and we need it for more than fleeting possession. And in order for there to be sufficient evidence for this court, it has to be more than a scintilla of evidence, and it needs to be more than lay conclusory statements that are merely that scintilla. What we know is that M.A., that Muna knew Mr. Abdi. She knew him by name, and she did not know what he was wearing that night. She knew that a person who was holding a gun was wearing gray and was a person who attacked Mr. Freeman. So we know that that's not Mr. Abdi. We know that Dalmar did not see Mr. Abdi with a weapon. And we know that Mr. Ali said the only person that he could say could explain to have a weapon was Antonio. So the state cannot prove here that there was enough evidence to convict Mr. Abdi of unlawful possession of a firearm. I'd like to turn, if I can, briefly to the hearsay evidence on the lineup that came in on a late objection by defense counsel and point out to the court that only statements of identification fall in under the hearsay rule under 801.1d sub 3. And the comments to the federal rules make clear that the basis for this is memory loss, suggestiveness of an in-court identification. It pertains only to the identification itself. So any statements that were not the identification of one of the defendants should not have come in under 801 D1 sub 3. Thanks, Your Honors. I'll reserve the remainder.
Okay, so you'll have 3 minutes on rebuttal then.
May it please the court. Casey Dranis on behalf of Mr. Saeed. The evidence is insufficient to convict Mr. Saeed of attempted first-degree robbery, and that count and that charge should be dismissed with prejudice. There's no dispute that the evidence is insufficient to convict Mr. Saeed on theory of principal liability, and based on the way in which the jury was instructed, the jury could not convict Mr. Saeed based on accomplice liability. Saeed's argument is consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in State v. Teal, as well as its decision in State v. Willis, both of which addressed accomplice liability instructions in the context of the law of the case doctrine.
How is it consistent with Teal? Teal said that it's accomplice liability is neither an element of the crime nor an alternative means of committing the crime.
And Saeed agrees with that part of, Saeed agrees with that, wholeheartedly. Teal stands for the proposition that accomplice liability language does not need to be included in the to-convict instruction.
So this is, it's consistent with Teal if Teal somehow were a law of the case doctrine decision. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Teal stands for the basic proposition that when the instructions read as a whole allow the jury to convict based on accomplice liability, then
why would you get dismissal with prejudice?
It gets down to whether or not the state proved its case.
Yeah. Let's say with regard to the added element, accomplice liability, the added element, the state didn't prove it. It's an added element. It's not part of the charge itself. Why would you get dismissal with prejudice?
In an added element case, such as Musacchio or this court's decision in Tyler, you don't get dismissal with prejudice. Saeed's argument is that this is not...
Well, you didn't get dismissal with prejudice at common law either, right?
That's right. By Saeed...
And the best that you can argue is that Hickman applied common law to create a law of the case doctrine, right? So if it's a common law right, it has a common law remedy. So what you really are down to is we get a new trial on this, right?
Disagree, Your Honor. Saeed's argument,
I anticipated that you would.
Saeed's argument is grounded in the 14th Amendment due process standard, not the common law standard in Washington. Now, I'm not conceding that Tyler was rightly decided, okay? But for the purpose
of
this argument,
if you go with the 14th Amendment rather than common law, how is Hickman the authority for your position?
Well, I'm citing Hickman as authority, as I do other
but
cases.
But isn't Hickman a common law case?
Well, I'm citing those cases for the general proposition that the law of the case is determined by the instructions that are given to the jury.
Excuse me, you've got two alternate choices here. You could choose a due process argument and argue the due process requires this additional element, or you can assert a common law theory, the law of the case doctrine that Hickman provides. But you seem to want to pick part of your case from one and the remedy from the other.
Well, Your Honor, the argument is that those two theories, the law of the case and the sufficiency of evidence standard under due process, are not mutually exclusive in all cases. Because this
what case supports that position?
Well, I look at
that they cross over and somehow blend.
Well, in light of Masaccio, no case has addressed the law of the case doctrine, the sufficiency of evidence standard, and accomplice liability and how that all factors in. So there's no case I can point to that says one way or the other what the result is here.
You'll have a minute on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Ian Eath, representing the state of Washington, the respondent in this matter. I'll focus on the three basic issues here and be happy to answer any.
Let me ask you a question about one that wasn't addressed.
Yes, please.
That wasn't addressed. This is with regard to the mistrial request.
Okay.
After the state moved to dismiss the charge that involved, I believe, Mr. Freeman.
That's
okay. Okay. So there was evidence that was admitted that tended to support the charges against Mr. Freeman.
Correct.
Then the state moved to dismiss the charge against Mr. Freeman.
Correct.
And then there was a motion for a mistrial.
Correct.
Yeah. Why do we care?
We don't.
How does it change? How is the circumstances any different than if that count had gone to the jury and the jury had acquitted?
It's not, and the other way to analyze
it. In fact, that happened in this case, right? That with regard to one of the other defendants, there was either an acquittal or a hung jury, right?
That's correct. There was an acquittal and a hung jury.
Do we have to give a new trial because there was evidence admitted against the defendant that was acquitted or there was a hung jury?
No, and the other way to analyze it is to pretend that the charge pertaining to Mr. Freeman was never levied at all.
Well, I understand that, and that's what the briefing's about. I'm trying to get to something more basic. If the charge against that involved Mr. Freeman had been dismissed, the euphemism is at halftime, if it had been dismissed at the end of the state's case, would the defendants have been entitled, the other defendants have been, or the defendants have been entitled to a mistrial on all of the other counts because that evidence had come in?
Of course not, and because the evidence is not, the evidence was admissible as highly relevant to all the remaining charges.
Well, let's say it wasn't. Let's just say it wasn't. Let's say it was particular to Mr. Freeman.
Okay.
Does a mistrial or a new trial necessarily follow?
It wouldn't be our position.
Is there any authority for that proposition?
I don't think so. I mean, you'd have to look, I guess.
If it was true for a halftime motion, it would have to be true for an acquittal, right?
True.
And there is no case out there that says if a defendant or a co-defendant is acquitted or there's a hung jury on one of the counts just because evidence came in that wasn't cross-admissible, that the remaining defendants who were convicted get new trials, right?
I agree with you.
Okay. Well, I'm asking this because you didn't argue it.
Yeah.
And so I'm just trying to figure out, did I miss that day in school?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think you just may be more clever than me.
Okay. Well, I don't know about that. I didn't get to work on time. So.
No, I agree. I have take no issue with that at all. As to the sufficiency of the evidence argument, I would prefer not to, as the appellants are here, recreate a closing argument, because that's not what we do here in at the appellate court level. What the appellants are asking you to do on the sufficiency of the evidence argument is to weigh the various credibility of the various witnesses, to resolve conflicts between conflicting witnesses, to try to determine which pieces of evidence should be given more weight. None of those are things that happen here at the appellate level, as you are well aware. The issue is whether there was evidence in the record before the jury sufficient for a reasonable jury to convict when looked at through the lens with the light most favorable to the state. And that's the bottom line on that issue. The inferences that Ministers Saeed and Abdi are attempting to make are they're inviting you to look at the evidence all through their lenses, and that's not the proper standard of review here. The evidence before the jury here was ample to convict both of them of unlawful possession of a firearm because the evidence existed that put a gun in each of their hands at some point during the course of the events. And I'm going to decline to go through that in detail. I would just invite you to look at the record carefully.
What about the attempted robbery charge?
As to the attempted robbery charge, first of all, the issue of whether the law of the case applies here is actually somewhat of a red herring, in my opinion, because if you look, you have to remember that this was an attempted robbery charge. What the state had to prove in this case was that the defendants each had an intent to commit first-degree robbery while armed, under the armed prong, and that each of them made some substantial step toward the commission of that crime. That's what needed to be proved in this case. Both appellants here would like you to believe that the only way one can commit an attempted armed robbery is to pick up a gun, stick it in somebody's face, demand money, and fail to receive it. But that's only one of myriad ways to commit an attempted robbery. So to say that the state was obligated to prove principal liability insofar as one of them actually held a gun misses the point, because the obligation of the state was only to prove that each of them took some substantial step towards the commission of the armed robbery. And that could be anything as simple as getting in the car to go to the Gessler Terrace apartments. It could be something as simple as being one of the people that knocked on the door and demanded that
somebody come outside. After the initial contact at the residence, would walking back to the car and opening the trunk with two other people while two people, we don't care which two, get guns out be enough?
Of course. The argument might, I suppose, have more credence if we were talking about a completed crime. I don't really think that it would, but it ignores the fact that this is an attempt crime. And so the suggestion that there was an obligation of the state to put a gun in somebody's hand in order to prove attempted robbery is simply not true. And so whether Hickman applies or not, and of course our position is that Tyler is absolutely correctly decided, whether that is true or not doesn't really matter in this case. The last issue I would like to talk to you about is the hearsay evidence, and just to remind the panel that we're not talking about the simple question about whether or not this was admissible. This is framed as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim of error, which means that they need to prove deficient performance and prejudice, and they can do neither. And if you don't have any other questions, I will pass on the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Zink, are you going to go first in rebuttal?
I'm going to let Mr. Grant go first.
All right. You're going to be the cleanup here. Huh? Let's see. Mr. Grannis, you have 1 minute.
All right. So the state's theory on the attempted robbery charge seems to be that, well, as long as a substantial step is taken by anyone under accomplice liability, then that's going to prove the first-degree attempted robbery. The problem with that is that conflates the first-degree attempted robbery with the second-degree attempted robbery, because it's the intent to get the to use the weapon as part of the robbery is what separates those two.
Well, for accomplice liability, you have to intend to be assisting the crime. But the crime is robbery, not first-degree robbery or second-degree robbery, right? Well, the crime is the type of crime, robbery or kidnapping or assault, not the degree.
No, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. Saeed's charged with attempted first-degree robbery, which means that he has to have...
He is, but what does he have to know he's trying to participate in?
Yeah.
And so that crime that's at issue is the first-degree robbery, which includes the deadly weapon portion of that.
So he has to know the difference between first- and second-degree robbery for him to intend to commit a crime and take a substantial step towards committing first-degree robbery?
Well, as an accomplice, he needs to know that one of his co-defendants was going to commit that crime.
Evidence that three people walked to the car, opened a trunk, and two of them left with guns. The dispute is who those two are.
Right.
There's no dispute that there were guns, so the person would know that there is an armed robbery attempted if they're doing anything in connection with this activity, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Now...
Ms. Zink has 3 minutes left. You want to give him part of your time? How much do you want? As much as he wants? All right. You can see the clock. You can holler him if he's using up too much.
So in terms of the accomplice liability theory of conviction here for this attempted first-degree robbery conviction, the reason why this is an attempted first-degree robbery charge is that the robbery that was attempted was not actually completed. The defendants, co-defendants, did not actually obtain any property from the person. That's why this is an attempted first-degree robbery. And when we're looking at the way the jury was instructed, we have to look at the instructions considered as a whole to determine whether the jury could convict based on a theory of accomplice liability. Now, it's true that the accomplice liability is not an element of the crime, but this is not an additional element case. That term is used in the side. It's not a full.
Isn't it sufficient for the state to show a substantial step by each defendant, and that at least one of the participants in the crime, even if not charged, had a gun during the confrontation and the demand?
Under an accomplice liability theory, that would be sufficient as long as the one who's being charged as an accomplice. It knew that the other person had a gun.
Well, if the victim could see the gun, presumably the other two people standing at the door could be inferred to see it.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay,
I agree with that. That's what the record... I mean, look at the...
The record has three people at the door, correct?
You got three people at the car. One person's pointing the gun at the window. The other two, Saeed being one of them, are at the car itself. Under an accomplice liability theory, if the jury was allowed to convict based on that theory, Saeed acknowledges that the evidence is sufficient. The argument, though, is that the jury could only consider principal liability in the context of the instructions in this case. To determine whether the elements of a crime have been proved under a due process standard, we have to consider that in relation to whether or consider that in relation to the theory of liability that's being advanced. And the way that theory of liability is advanced is by way of the jury instructions. When there is no jury instruction on accomplice liability at all, the evidence is going to be insufficient to convict for accomplice liability. That much is clear in our case law. And in this case, what we're looking at is we're looking at the instructions as a whole and whether a reasonable juror, when looking at the lack of accomplice language in the charge that we're talking about now, and comparing that to the parallel to convict instruction for the attempted robbery on which he was acquitted, that the reasonable juror in that situation is going to conclude that the omission of the accomplice language was purposeful and that the jury had to rely on principal liability to convict on that count. And the evidence is insufficient to convict on principal liability.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next case this morning is Sherberg versus Griffith.